Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the picture, what I've left behind. You once again I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Good evening and welcome to the Stop Child Abuse Now show. This is scan number 2724. That's 2724. Tonight we're going to have a good show. I'm hoping that our guest is able to show up. And her name is Dr. Lena G. Clark, and she is from Alpharetta, Georgia. She is a domestic violence survivor, coach, and author. She's an expert in the areas of mental health. I'm always interested in all that stuff because I've worked in places like that. So I'm hoping that she will be able to call in tonight. But until she does, okay, and if she doesn't, Michael is here. He's my police officer. That's what he is. Yes, he is. He's my detective. Anyway, he's here. And we will run a show on our own. And first of all, let me get the mission statement out of the way, and then I'll get the telephone number here. And we'll see what happens. Your guess is as good as mine. Okay. We have a singleness of purpose at NASCA, and that is to address issues related to child abuse and trauma, including sexual assault and violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas, and neglect. And we do so from two different ways. One is educating the public, especially as related to getting society over the taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, presenting the facts that show child abuse to be a pandemic, which we all know, it's worldwide, and it does affect everyone. I like to talk about that at times because people seem to think if it happened to Johnny Brown down the street, it's not going to happen anywhere and it's not going to affect them. They're wrong. Okay. Number two is offering hope for healing through numerous paths and providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse, and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. So that's just a little bit of what we do here at NASCA. I want to give out the telephone number. It is 646-595-2118. That's 646-595-2118. So we're going to have an interesting show one way or another tonight. I'm not too sure what's going on here with our guests. I think two got scheduled for the same night, and now neither one of them are here, but we're here. Yes, we are. Michael and I are here. So what I need to talk about tonight, and I think it's very, very important, is emotional abuse because, you see, emotional abuse is something they consider that to be one of the hardest abuses to actually detect. And yet, whether it be with children or whether it be with adults, the emotional abuse, it definitely takes, you know, a toll on the individual, okay? And that's something that we should talk about, and it's important. I'm glad that I looked it up before the show. People do ask me about emotional abuse. We have physical, mental, emotional, you know, sexual, and we have neglect. Now, we've got all that. And unfortunately, there's many of us who have gone through all of that. What does it do to a person? Believe me, it screws them up, as I say, because that's exactly what it does. I'm going to speak about a little bit about the the effects on how, what it does with children, because quite frankly, that's what we're, you know, addressing right now tonight, but we can also do with the adults, and believe me, it does take a toll on us. I see that Bill is here also. Michael, I'm thankful that you called in, and I'm going to put your name here because you are here. We're going to be talking about gaslighting, too. That's important. People don't know what that means, okay, and how it affects relationships. Hold on a second. And now we've got Bill. I'm going to open up his mic. There you are. There's the man. How you
Hi,
doing?
Hi, Carol.
Yeah.
I'm well, thank you. Michael is with us. Where's Michael from?
Michael is from Texas, and he's Michael Lee, and he's a detective.
Right, I know Michael. I just didn't know which Michael was. Hi, Mike.
Oh.
Hi.
Yeah, I know
Michael. Yeah. So, anyway, so I'm, no, I don't know. Clark. Are you saying something? Go ahead.
I said there's no Lena Clark yet. You want me to go see what's up with her?
Well, yeah, and then also, too, one who usually shows up on this Tuesday is Lori Golden. I think there was a mix-up there. I have a funny feeling. I do not remember sending one out to Dr. Lena G, but I may have. But you can go lasso one of the two. I don't know what to say.
Okay.
Okay, go ahead.
All right, thanks.
And I'm going to...
Yeah,
I'm going to start in on this because this is something that people have to understand and really, really do have to. You know, Michael, with abusive relationships, you being a detective, and, you know, you've seen so much with domestic violence, and that is a terrible thing for children to see. And certainly many times, like the March of Dimes, I think I mentioned that about a few weeks ago, said that 70%...
Yep.
Of kids, then they too become a victim, okay? So it doesn't stay, and I don't mean just, but it doesn't stay just between the adults. It then flows over into the child. And, you know, it does have terrible, terrible effects on a child to watch domestic violence. Now, we understand this, but what a lot of people don't understand is what actually happens to kids who... unfortunately, are victims, I'm going to say victims, of emotional abuse, okay? That's terrible. And so in many ways, emotional abuse has sometimes more lasting effects than physical abuse. Now, that's a biggie right there. Emotional abuse is more personal. It is more about you as a person. It's about your spirit. Like if someone says to you, you're ugly, you're stupid, you're incompetent, you'll never, you know, turn into anything good, and no one could ever love you. Unfortunately, children are spoken to that way. You are more likely to think that we, you know, that you are the problem. They internalize. That's what they do. They internalize. I see someone here who is here from the 682 area code 710. Hold on a second. Let me see who that is. 682, who am I speaking to? This is Carol Levine from the Stop Child Abuse Show.
Hey, it's Richard Winman.
Hi, Richard. How are you doing? I'm glad you're here.
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Good. Well, I'm glad you're here. Now, I'll give out the number one more time, but I think we're going to do fine just with what we have here. The telephone number is 646-595-2118. That's 646-595-2118. 2118. Now, Michael and I were talking about emotional abuse, and you know, a lot of people, they don't understand emotional abuse, and even with the psychotherapists, okay, the psychiatrists, they don't understand emotional abuse as much maybe as they could, you know, and they should, because it's very devastating to a child and an adult if the adult is the victim, okay. You know, to go through emotional abuse, because what happens is, what does it affect? It affects their self-esteem, and that's only a little bit of it, you know. And so what I'm saying here is because we tend to expect that those we love will care about how we feel. Well, they don't care about how we feel. They wouldn't do that. It says, one loves, one fails to care that they are hurt. It feels like betrayal. It does feel like betrayal. Yeah. And then I have many articles always, so I'm just going to read a little bit from it, but use it because I don't really need to use it. But it says, there are many ways to be emotionally abusive, and you can say the most loving words with sarcasm. I want you to think about this. The most loving words with sarcasm. Communicate contempt with body language, and that's like rolling your eyes and disgusted looks, cold shoulders. Emotional abuse can happen between parent and child, husband and wife, among relatives, and between friends. Emotional abuse occurs when a person in a relationship tries to control information available to another person with the intent to manipulate them, and so forth. And that's where gaslighting comes in. Gaslighting is when the person is, abusing, whether it be a spouse or a child. They try to make that child or that spouse think that they're crazy. They do this. Don't you remember when? And maybe the incident didn't even really happen, but they're just trying, they're messing with their minds. They're actually getting that person to, sit and think, am I going crazy? Why don't I remember that event? Or why, and I've been there. I had a very abusive first husband that would hit me with all kinds of things like that. I didn't understand it then, but I certainly understand it now. Now, with children, what it does affect mostly, it says emotional abuse, like with silent treatment. How many times have we gone through, even as ourselves, to say it's not even, domestic violence or anything like that. Say we're teenagers, and we're with a teenager that we think we love and all this other stuff, and they're falling out of love with you, and what do? They give you the silent treatment. That happens in relationships, okay? It doesn't matter whether it's amongst kids or whether it's amongst adults. And unfortunately, too many of us go through that. So with a child, right, when a child is always downed, they're never shown love. There's no physical love, even a tap on the head, I don't care what it is. They're never praised. They turn into having all different kinds of problems emotionally. What's that? I don't know. Someone said something. I don't know. But anyway, what happens is children, and it can come out behaviorally. Now, Michael, you being a detective, and many times you were called to domestic violence scenes. I know this. And I want to say something about that because, when you're called to a domestic violence situation, okay, you don't know what the characters are like. You don't know if they have guns. You don't know if they have knives. You don't know what's going on in that situation. And you're in a very volatile situation is what you are. You're in a very volatile situation. And you don't know what to expect. And with children, sometimes I work with this in detention, if they get downed too much at home, say they get beaten, and that can go along with the emotional abuse. The two can go together, or they get sexually abused. It can be a combination of the three. Sometimes that kid will actually, rebel against their parents. And I'm just wondering, how many times have you ever gone to, you've answered the call, domestic violence, and it's actually like the teenagers who have turned on the parents. How many times have you seen that?
Yeah, I mean a lot. The way those calls typically would roll across too is unfortunately they would call them child discipline calls. And you have to consider that in Texas, our statute involving what type of force can be applied to your child in the course of administering discipline, the statute basically says that a parent or a person acting in loco parentis, meaning just anybody who is acting as if they are the parent, so that could be a school teacher or a daycare worker, can use any force that they deem appropriate on a child that does not include serious bodily injury or death in order to promote the discipline or the welfare, you know, that they deem appropriate for that instance with that child. So it's you know, unfortunately, the statute's kind of dangerous in how loose it is, but I think the reason it was written that way and it stayed that way for a long time is because, you know, Southerners kind of pride themselves in the fact that, you know, hey, whenever I was a kid and I did wrong, you know, I was told to go pick out a switch and, you know, and then that's what they used to tan my hide. So, you know, if it was good for the goose, it's got to be good for the gander. And, you know, the reality of it is that the, you know, most of the professionals today will say that if it's something that you're leaving a mark on a child that lasts longer than a day, you know, 24 hours, that was abusive. That was physically abusive. But, you know, when it comes to those, like the behavioral problems that when children do rebel and they do all that stuff, I mean, obviously there's going to be some form of questioning that, you know, as an investigator, I notice this is the difference between us and patrol. Patrol officers go out there and want to side with the parents because it's easier to address it like it is a child discipline issue and not child abuse. You know, if it's child abuse, there's all these extra things we got to do now. You know, it's going to take a lot of time, it's a lot of effort and energy to deal with that. And, you know, it's easier to just, you know, take the word of the parent, right, because we'd rather believe them anyways, you know. And they're not asking the right questions. And the right questions is always kind of needs to be like, what's going on? You know, it's okay, you can talk to me, tell me what's going on here. But, I mean, for sure, you know, the kids at an early age have got to have some form of emotional and physical connection with their parents. And there's countless numbers of studies out there where, you know, in the absence of that, the child will develop some very strange ideas about their sense of self. You know, they may be more prone to disassociative behaviors or psychopathy, sociopathy, because of that kind of stuff. You know, so that's, you know, when you do have a parent that is engaging in a lot of emotional, verbal, psychological abuse with a child, like you said, that could be, you know, much more damaging than the actual physical or sexual abuse, in the sense that it's creating very long-lasting issues with how the child relates to themselves and the world around them. You know, so if we're, you know, trying to create a personality on a foundation made of sand, I mean, that's going to obviously, you know, create problems later in life. And we used to tell parents, even as patrolmen, and I still kind of stand by this, you know, parents that have problems with their 15-year-old kid, they're too big to whoop at that point. You know, you can't just go off and whoop your 15-year-old son that's 3 feet taller than you, you know. And, you know, what are you going to do now? And the reality of it is, and I told them then, and I'd tell them the same thing today, I can't fix in 15 minutes what you seem to mess up over the course of 15 years, okay?
That's right.
And that's absolutely true, you know, from no matter what case you're looking at, it's always going to be the same thing. If they had gotten, now, you know, there's some things that are beyond your control. If you didn't know that your significant other or Uncle Jimmy or Grandpa Joe was abusing them, you know, and there's some things that are kind of going on in the background. But, you know, one of the examples I will always use with parents is, you know, I get that you're not a professional. I get you're not, you know, a forensic psychologist or a counselor or whatever. And, you know, any person that goes to the daycare today to pick up their three-year-old, if they see a bone sticking out of the leg and that the child's bleeding, they're going to say, hey, that's a problem. We need to go to the hospital right now, because that's an obvious thing that they know. Bones are supposed to be inside the body. The blood's not supposed to be outside the body. Let's go get that taken care of. But oftentimes they don't recognize that, you know, habitual runaways, you know, early onset of drug abuse or sexual promiscuity in girls, self-harming behaviors and all those other kind of warning signs are kind of the same thing as the bone sticking out of the leg, you know. And as parents, you know, if they are tuned into this stuff, they'll know, hey, we need to go get them into some counseling now. And then you might be surprised to find out what starts kind of rolling out, you know, from the child at that point. Like, they're going to unpack that, right? It'll take some time, but a good counselor, therapist, if the child trusts them, some of that stuff's going to start rolling out. And that's typically, you know, how we will, as investigators, I get a lot of reports. I would say maybe 25 to 50% of my reports come in from either schools or, you know, therapists or whatever. They're making their initial reports because the child trusted them more than they trusted mom and dad.
Boy, that's so true. That's so true. Because, you see, again, too often they don't look inside the family unit, okay? They don't look inside the home and see where the child is coming from. They just feed the kids a brat. The kid needs, you know, whatever. They don't have any good feelings about the kid many times. But they don't take into consideration that the child maybe was beaten the day before or was down so much with the emotional abuse like I was speaking about. And it does something, and it turns out to be a behavioral type of problem. It comes from somewhere. It doesn't just, you know, develop. Let's see. We've got Bill, and then I'll go down to, how do you say your name? 682 again. I love you. What's your name again?
Richard Wenman.
Richard, yeah, I knew it was Richard. Okay. Yeah. All right, well, let's go to Bill, and then, Richard, I want to see what your take is on this. Maybe you've been through something like this. I remember you telling your story. I remember that, but I want to hear a little bit more from you. Hold on a second. Let's go to Bill because he is here. Okay, go ahead. Bill?
I think, you know, what people need to understand is these domestic violence calls are among the most difficult for officers and the most dangerous, frankly. You just don't know what you're going to walk into when you respond to one of these. And, you know, you can't tell who the good guy and the bad guy is a lot of times because both parties are yelling and screaming at each other. Here in Los Angeles, they have a mandate to bring in anyone who's not marked. In other words, the person that's marked, they assume, is the victim. And the person that's not marked, they assume, is the aggressor. It's not always the case, but they won't leave somebody behind if there is somebody that is marked. So they bring them in for at least one night. And that's how they handle it here, because they have a huge problem with being vulnerable. Now, the other thing they do is they have cops that go out with teams, another team of people. They call them sexual assault.
The psychologist, of course. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they send a psychologist often, and also a trained community member can go. It depends, you know, if you want to do this work, you have to take a certain number of courses and so forth. But you can be one of the people that's kind of on call in your area when something like this happens. So in that case, you have at least four people showing up. Could be a car and a backup car, too, but you have four people showing up. So, again, there's less chance that people are going to get hurt. And they separate the people, you know, to try and stay safe. But I don't know the story about the teenager that's, you know, a foot taller than his mom or his father. That's a tough one.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that's true. You know, I think about all the kids that I used to work with, you know, and Juvie. Many of them had pierce like we do. Now, I'm going to go down to Richard in just a second. And, you know, when you come from abusive households where you're being sexually abused, you're being beaten and with the terrible, terrible emotional abuse. I don't think you can't go through all those abuses without having the emotional abuse, which isn't really looked at enough, like I said, or understood quite.
Right.
Yeah. And because of that, with all those things going on in a kid's head, he or she, it doesn't have to be a boy. I mean, she can freak out too and all of a sudden just turn on the parents and do something horrible, because the person can only take so much. That's it, so much. And if it starts from at an early age and continues on, say, into teenage years, that child is ready, you know, to explode one way or another. You know, they just simply are. And we used to have to restrain them and everything in juvie. We had police officers, Michael, there that I worked with, because we had a lockdown facility. But, it's a shame. It's a shame. And you see, they're coming from past, like what we are so familiar with. Richard, what do you think about, do you feel like you were ever emotionally abused in your home when you were a kid growing up?
Oh, my God, yes. I had a terrible alcoholic father. He was in the Navy, and I wasn't allowed to call him Dad. I had to call him Chief all the time. Chief, and he was vicious. He would beat on my mom. One day when I was 4 years old, I thought I was big enough to stop it, and he took me by the arm and threw me against the wall, broke my arm. I was always told I was a piece of shit. I would never amount to anything. Then the abuse started, the sexual abuse, and like you say, gaslighting. A couple of responses. I actually came forward when I was a kid, and the two responses were, they didn't believe me, which, if you don't believe me, you don't believe me. I guess that's okay. But when they tell you that you're crazy, that you're insane, that mm-hmm. almost eclipses the actual act of abuse. It's horrible, horrible for somebody to call you insane, to call you crazy. It just cuts like a knife. It really messes you up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It absolutely does. Absolutely. So you see, we're like the product, many of us, not all of us, but we're like the product of, the past, that where we had all this abuse, whether it be just, whether it be physical, mental, emotional, sexual, and then neglect. So many times, mm-hmm. Kids, they go through this where they're told terrible things, and they believe it because, look, we're looking up to our parents, say. If you want to call them that. We're looking up to our parents for guidance. We're looking at them for love. We're looking at them for approval. We're looking at them for praise, all kinds of things that are in the normal type of household, at least we think. Remember, you don't know what's going on behind a door unless you're inside. I don't know how many truly normal households there are, and no one is 100% perfect. But if you come from a house where there is caring, there is, showing of affection, where someone will say, oh, I love you, and give them a hug. And that way the child, blooms and blossoms because they feel like they're approved of, and of course they are. Otherwise, mommy and daddy wouldn't say that, right? And they're given guidelines. They're given boundaries. So often, children like ourselves, we don't have boundaries. I didn't have boundaries. I could come and go as I pleased. I could do what I wanted. And I didn't make good choices. I didn't end up in juvie. I think I could run faster than the others because I was a very good athlete. And some of my friends, they ended up getting in trouble, you bet. And I had a few personal boundaries of my own. I absolutely did. And I would never ruin a person's property. Because I grew up in a family that they were very hard-working people, and they had their own properties, and they had their own businesses, and they took pride in the work that they did, and I was actually proud of them for what they achieved. Yeah. So that always stayed in my mind. I would not go and ruin someone's, hit the glass windows in stores or in people's houses or whatever. I wouldn't dream of doing that. I did have some boundaries. I have a 206 area code here. I'm not too sure who they are. Let me open up their mic and let's find out. Hi, this is Carol Levine with Stop Child Abuse. Yeah, who am I speaking to?
Carol, thank you. It's Penelope calling in.
Hi, Penelope. Mm-hmm. How you doing?
Hi, I'm Ooh. Great. I apologize. I'm driving with the family, but I wanted to call in and just be a part of what the show, for as long as I could be tonight. So, hi.
Well, I'm glad you called in. I absolutely am. We're having a good discussion on children and behavior, those of us that come from, you know, abusive backgrounds. And one of the things that I speak about many times is other places, not on the radio so much, but where I go, is about emotional abuse because it is not spoken about enough. And all I can work with is with the text, you know, the T-E-X-T that I have to work with and what I've learned along the way in classes. So, you know, all this emotional abuse that children go through, and then they wonder why kids turn into teenagers, you know, that are so destructive, you know, and they do such destructive things. And unfortunately, some of those kids, they commit suicide. You bet. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, and I, you know, I always feel like I hear, well, you know, I wasn't hit or I wasn't sexually abused. I was only, right, verbally abused or emotionally abused. And I feel like, you know, it's a disservice to minimize it because of the impact. And I'll tell you, you know, from my own experience, I have experienced all forms of abuse in the family of origin. Severe physical abuse, sexual abuse. The most penetrating and enduring was the emotional abuse and verbal abuse. The most penetrating and enduring. And so, from my own experience, and so I completely agree with your statement. I mean, it is the effects are profound, and they can be long-lasting.
Well, you know, that's why with all the information I have here, they're saying that emotional abuse is like worse than, you know, being physically beaten, that it lasts with you longer. And I believe that. I believe that. Because I came from a family, if you want to call it that, where there was so much emotional abuse, where I was downed all the time, made to feel less than. I was never going to amount to anything. All these things, you know, that they say, the gaslighting that takes place, making you feel like you're crazy. Why don't you remember what happened, you know, a couple of years ago? Why don't you remember that, you know, and things like that. And, you know, unfortunately, when a child grows up, let's just say, and I don't mean this, I'm not trying to take away the devastating effects of, you know, of emotional abuse, but if a child goes through emotional abuse without the physical, without the sexual and the neglect in other ways, you know, that still can cause all kinds of problems. It can cause PTSD. What is PTSD? Post-traumatic stress disorder. When a child is told that they're worthless, they're not going to amount to anything. Why don't you get better grades in school? Why do you go to school at all? What are you going to do? You know, things like that, I'm just saying. If they get, you know, that type of feedback, then that child who is supposed to look at their parents with love and adoration and all this other stuff, what happens is time after time after time when they have to listen to this, you know, these parents who just don't accept them, especially if there's another sibling who is treated so much better. Okay.
Alanis Morissette's song, Perfect, describes this perfectly. I encourage you to listen to it.
Let me write that down. Who was that?
Alanis Morissette. And the song is called Perfect.
Oh, I like that. Okay, and it's called Perfect. See, I love to do this. I do a lot of research work because I find it fascinating. I like this type of thing. But I would love to listen to that and then maybe have a show on it because maybe even invite the person on the show. I have a couple people who I'm going to invite, who are invited to come on the show very soon. And they're from different organizations.
And I believe...
The reason...
Oh, I'm sorry. I believe Alanis Morissette also wrote the song. I think it's called Luca, and it's about a little boy who was sexually abused. She's been pretty verbal with the child abuse topic.
Mm-hmm.
That's
her right.
Dog.
That's right. The verbal abuse, and they consider that in with the emotional abuse in the articles that I have here. Because when you verbally abuse a child, oh, my. You, say, for instance, you have a kid in the store, okay, and you are abusing them and humiliating. So humiliation is the other one. You have humiliation along in there. And these people, I'm not even going to call them parents. They don't deserve that title, okay? They take the child who's their victim. Usually there's one. Say there's three kids, one's going to get it, believe me. You know, that's just the way it is. And many times they will humiliate them in public. I remember seeing kids with bright red faces in a store, say, because they're being yelled at and belittled, so, and, you know, from their parents. And, you know, and they just turn red as a beet. And sometimes they cry, sometimes they don't. So you see the verbal abuse, whether there's cursing involved or whether it's, again, to demean, whatever the case might be, this destroys a child too. And this is a part of what's wrong with society today. These children who are acting out, whether it be in school or whether it be at home and school, because it usually starts at home, and then they take it out on the streets. You know, these children many, many times have been made to feel that they are so inferior, that they're just worthless, and they're not worthy of love. And you know the old saying, if your own mother can't love you, well, you know, who can? You know, things like that. Then they go out on the street, and they become maniacal. And whether they take it out on the street kids, because that's what I'm used to seeing, taking it out, you know, starting fights, they become the bullies. The bullies are the ones that come from homes, like what we're speaking about many times. Because in the house, they're being bullied. So then, therefore, they take it out on the street. So, you know, this is something, there should be some kind of law when, you know, if the school system would look into, if they can, the social workers would look into the homes, or police department has enough to deal with. So let's say like CPS or whatever, really look into and understand, you know, the home, what they're coming from. Then they can better work with, you know, the child, and hopefully they won't turn into a sociopath or something when they get older, okay? It's a terrible conflict. Go ahead.
So I'll talk to you about another kind of verbal abuse. It's snappy. It's actually stifling children. So I was not allowed, after I was physically beaten, after I was verbally abused or emotionally abused, I was not allowed to express my emotion. And I had to stress myself. And those emotions that are delayed and deferred are not destroyed. And I really believe that you have to express those emotions because a child needs to nurture themselves when they're hurt. But I believe also contributed to my dissociation because I had to train myself to become numb. I didn't dare show my emotion. So that verbal abuse and then not being able to have an emotional response to that, I believe is another form of verbal abuse.
Well, I can identify with you because, you see, if I dared try to cry, I can't cry today. I cry if I have to put an animal down, one of my cats or something. Right? That makes me bawl. They'll take me out of the building to get me away from the people. They did that with my last cat. I was bawling my eyes out, and they took me out the back door because I was too loud. But, you know, when I was a kid growing up, you know, whether I was being verbally abused or, you know, the emotional abuse was there, all in set, and it has all different categories to it, whether it be, you know, you're verbally abused or whether you're being demeaned, you know, being made less than, and all the other things that go with it. Unfortunately, if I tried to cry, or I had to get to the point where I wanted to cry and I couldn't cry, if I did, they would put me outdoors, and they didn't care if it was 2 degrees out. They didn't care if I had a jacket on. You're out. That's it. You show emotion, you're out. And no one ever showed any love either, okay? There was no love, you know, like patting the kid on the head like I said, hey, good job or whatever, whatever. So these kids that we're dealing with today, all these kids that are out being so destructive, if you could look into where they come from, then you would see it could be generational. It could be generational. It isn't always, though. It could be. You know, it starts back with the grandparents, say, and maybe their parents before, and it becomes a generational problem where the kid then, he doesn't or she doesn't have a chance because this is how the parents are. And Bill, I think you said earlier, or maybe it wasn't Bill, I forget who it was, said that, well, you know, oh, no, Michael, it was you. You said, like, down south, you were referring to, like, the people down there. And I do know that there are people that think, you know, hey, I got through it. Suck it up, okay? If you're going to mouth off at me, if you dare to, right, then you're going to get smacked in the head. You see, that violence begets violence, okay? This is what people have to understand. You have to find solutions, like Bill said earlier, solutions, you know, to behavior. And unfortunately, a lot of people aren't taught that because they come from a generational type of background. Michael, how often do you deal with that where you know it's generational?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably a majority of the time those are traits that are passed down, you know, because we all kind of like become, I don't know if it's lesser versions than of our parents, right? Where we're a little bit more forgiving or whatever, you know, we're not quite as strict as they were, but we still kind of rely on our own experience, our own childhood, mm-hmm. for that kind of data on how to raise a child. And it's one of the things I harp on a lot, you know, and I will crawl all over a patrol officer anytime I see it. Because it just makes me so angry, but like we'll see people that'll even get on their Facebook accounts and post things like, you know, what's wrong with society today is that they're, you know, kids aren't getting their butts whooped, you know, they need to be spanked more or whatever the case may be. And I have heard, you know, like body camera recordings where that's what they're telling the parents. And you got to think about, you know, like there's a certain level of discipline that would maybe be appropriate under certain context, but you have to consider too the ramifications that, like, it's not lost on me that I'm an authority figure for a lot of people, and whenever I go and have interactions with somebody and I tell them, hey, look, you know, this is what you need to do, this is what you need to know, that they take that like the gospel truth. And mm-hmm. if you have a police officer that's going and telling, you know, somebody that was, you know, like raised in Hannibal Lecter's home, you know what I mean? That, right. Hey, you know what's wrong with your child is you're not being physically abusive enough with them to teach them to stop acting like that. You're not fixing problems. You're making them worse. You're adding fuel to the fire. And that's it's right. not, you know, hitting kids isn't going to make them better. It's going to make them worse. You know, listening to them and teaching them and helping them unpack those feelings and emotions appropriately is what's going to help those kids. But, you know, show me anywhere in the United States a patrol officer that knows how to explain that to a parent in 5 seconds. You know what I mean?
It's impossible.
You know,
right.
Yeah, it's impossible. So, you know, a lot of times we look at things like it's a Band-Aid fix. You know, and, you know, circle back around to the I can't fix in 15 minutes what it took you 15 years to screw up as a parent, right?
That's
impossible to do. But again, and I would tell people all the time, I'd tell them, hey, look, I wish I could go reach in the back of my car and pull out a handbook to give to you that would answer all of these questions, show you how to do this the right way. But the problem with being a parent is you're raising a human being, and human beings are extraordinarily complex creatures, and there's no, you know, one-size-fits-all kind of solution to these kind of problems, that they're extraordinarily complex. But if you care about your loved ones, you will invest that time and energy in fixing that problem. But if you don't care, it's not going to get fixed, and the child will feel that. You know, they'll know that the parent doesn't care.
You know, there's one organization, it's called Winona's House. And we had them on years ago, and I'm going to contact them because I had contacted Deidre's House, which is in Morristown. Winona's House is in Newark. Now, they're two different organizations. But Winona's House does work with the family. They work with them they give them, you know, a couple of months of real heavy-duty attention where they go for classes, you know, where parents go for classes, and to try and break through that barrier, okay, that terrible way that they were brought up, which is generational, and to try and reach them, to show them, look, there is another way. If you have to discipline your child, there are other alternatives. You don't hit. Okay, you don't do that. You don't beat your child. And it's not okay if you were beaten. And I'm sorry that you were beaten, but that doesn't mean that it's good for you to therefore beat your child, you see. It's to try and get through that. And then after they actually release the those people, you know, that caseload is then closed. What they do is they do allow for them to come back, I don't know, maybe once a month or once every 2 months and just report into someone, a social worker that they're assigned to. And then just say, hey, how are you doing? How is everything going? And blah, 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 blah. And they know that they can contact them if there is a major problem. So there's organizations out there that I really admire, okay, where they work with the families. And Deidre's House, she's on vacation. She should be back on the 11th. That's tomorrow. And I would like to have her on. Bill and I have discussed this. And I think she probably will come on, and that's a total different thing, but very, very, very good. And, you know, organizations, there are organizations, people out there, that do care, that do work with the families, that do work with children. And unfortunately, sometimes the families are too far gone. I hate to put it that way. And they can't be put back together. You can't fix them. And then the kids end up in foster care, or they end up in juvie, and then we have to take them before the judge, and then the judge decides if they go to foster care or they go back to the home, which made them upset. I'm not going to say they're bad. Kids are not bad, okay? They're not bad. What happens is the environment in which they're in helps form the way that they become, and that's the problem right there. Let me go to Richard here. Richard, what do you think about all of this? I mean, were you like a kid out on the street, you know, being bad and stuff like that, or, you know, doing things that were against the law or whatever, or did you internalize all the things that you went through? What did you do? How did you behave?
When I was, you know, the way my dad treated me and when I was being abused, I acted out. I wasn't a super bad kid, but, you know, my thing was stealing cars, coming up with schemes, running a gang in the neighborhood. I acted out and thank God I always did great in school. I always excelled in my academics, but, you know, when in my free time, you know, I was constantly in trouble. I was really lucky. I had a DA's investigator who investigated the Boy Scout case that I was involved in. He kind of took me under his wing, and every time I'd get in trouble, man, he'd be there with two lawyers, and he got me out of a lot of trouble and saved me a bunch of times. He was my guardian angel for much longer than he had to. And actually, he's the chairman of the board of our organization now. I went through that phase in my life. I did. And it stopped when I tried to commit suicide when I was 19.
Mm-hmm. 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 Yeah. I tried when I was 17. I got caught. So.
Not me. I was in the hospital for 3 days in a coma.
Oh, my God. God bless you. Yeah. Well, I thought I'd be all right because I had a friend who was living with us. My mother let me have kids live with us because we had huge houses. And she didn't want to talk to me anyway. So I thought she was out on a date, and I figured she'd be gone for hours. And she wasn't. She had a bad date, so she came home. And my mother was standing on one side saying, do it, and do it right. I was slicing my wrist. I have my little scar here. And my stepfather was on the other side going, ja, ja. He was Danish. That's the way he spoke, ja, ja. But, you know, they don't realize, or they don't care, or they're ignorant. I don't know which it is, as to child rearing, you know, how all these negative effects, being sexually abused, being physically, mentally, emotionally, and neglected, what it does to a child. And then, you know, when the kid goes wrong, I don't like saying, like I said, I don't really like saying bad, but when a kid is troubled and behaves in such a certain way, they say, why? Why? You know? Yeah, why? Let's go to Bill. I want to see what he has to say about behavior, and if he was a naughty boy on the streets, I'm not sure.
I wasn't really so naughty. I did a lot of drugs on the street, but I wasn't a violent person or anything like that. So I don't know what category I would have fit into, because I was not a troublemaker, certainly. But, you know, the thing I was thinking about is we've been talking mostly about physical encounter, physical abuse, but the emotional stuff is sometimes worse. Because that it can really deeply affect a person and their psyche, and that will lead to all kinds of other things as they grow older and become adolescents and then young teens, young adults and so forth. And that I had. You know, I didn't have the penchant to violence, but boy, I was hurt, and that came out in all kinds of ways. So that was more like me now.
Well, you know, with me, I was out on the streets, but I chose to be, hold on, make this a little louder. I'm having not the greatest connection here, storms as usual. With me, I ran away several times, and my mother told me to run away, so I wanted to anyway, because my brother was abusing me, so, and she didn't care. So when I got out on those streets, you know, it's really funny because I said to someone the other day, I was treated better out on the streets than I was at home. I just simply was. I was like their little sister because a lot of them are a lot older than me, okay? And so they would, like, shield me. They would never let me do, you know, like shoot heroin like they were doing and stuff like that, and or snort it, whatever they were doing. No. It was okay, though, if I drank, you see? So I always had a way of getting beer, you know, and I loved beer. I was a beer drinker, and I was just a kid. I started drinking when I was 13, 14 years old. By the time I was 16, I was like a full-fledged alcoholic, and I noticed that I was still in school, and I noticed that all of a sudden, all my academics, everything went down, and with my gymnastics, and I was a runner, all of a sudden I couldn't run as fast, and I was smoking like a maniac. I couldn't run as long. I could still do the 50-yard dash. I used to win awards in school for the, you know, for my abilities in gymnastics and all that. But that got ruined. That got ruined. It absolutely did. So, and then I didn't care anymore, because no one cared at home, you know what I'm saying? So I didn't have any proper guidance. And once you're out on the street and you're really with the people, the street people out there, you have your own type of family, if you will. And then, of course, you can have also the volatile type of family, and I knew to stay away from them and things like that. And I would actually get a ride home, because they're older than me. They knew people. And I would sneak into the basement, because in those days you didn't lock your doors, okay? You just didn't. You didn't even think about it. And I'd go up into the kitchen, make sure it was like 2, 3 o'clock in the morning, someone's not going to be there. And I'd steal food and then go back to the streets. And I'd go down the basement. It was a nice basement, and I'd wash and clean up the best that I could. And then, you know, so that's what I used to do, and then go back out. There was only one time when I came home, I actually came home, and it was about, well, I don't know, about 4 o'clock in the morning. I saw a red cigarette. I saw the tip of a cigarette. My mother always had filmy type of curtains where you could see through them, that type, you know. And I'm walking towards the house, and I see her cigarette, and I go, oh, boy, now what's going to happen? And then I went in, and actually she didn't hit me or anything. She didn't speak to me. She didn't say anything. She didn't say, why aren't you coming home anymore or anything of that stuff. But I stayed in because winter was there. And you see, I was in better shape, Bill, because I could go back home. It's just that I wasn't treated well at home at all. I was scared to death. And then when spring or summer would come, you know, I'd go back out. Or by that time, I had made a lot of friends, and we ended up going upstate New York and so forth. And I ended up singing in New York City, too. Yes, I did, and that was a lot of fun. I do have some good memories in my life. Let me go down the panel and see if anyone, you don't have to tell me what they are, but Michael, do you have any memories that are really good in your life that you can look back on in your life?
Yeah, I can remember when I was really young, maybe about 5 or 6 years old, my dad played a trick on me during Christmas where he took me, you know, of course at the time I thought Santa Claus was still real, and he took me outside and, you know, of course he knew, of course, you know, me being 5, I didn't know any better, but he knew based on where we lived that we were kind of like in the approach path for like a major airport, right? So at night, there's, you know, 747s on approach going into Houston, you know, and I didn't know that, you know, but he told me, he's like, oh, look, there was a reported sighting of Santa Claus kind of thing. So he took me outside, and he's shown me like an airplane on approach basically to Houston, and he told me that that was Santa Claus because Santa Claus has lights on his sleigh. And of course, in the meantime, while we're doing that and I'm getting all excited, you know, my mom had gone and grabbed like my bicycle or whatever was going to be my Christmas present and put it in the living room by the Christmas tree. And then when we came back inside, he was like, oh, look, you know, he was here. He dropped off your bicycle and stuff, you know. And I thought it was real. I mean, there wasn't any convincing me it wasn't real, you know. And I'll remember that forever, you know. I mean, there's a lot of those lessons that he taught me that were great lessons when I was growing up. Of course, he was an older, I mean, you know, he died last year during COVID at the age of 85. But you know, he had done 58 years in law enforcement. You know, by the time he retired, and he was one of the longest serving police officers in Texas. They flew a flag over the state capitol a month after he died, and then Governor Greg Abbott signed a little paper, you know, like an official decree of some, you know, kind through the state. And, you know, they sent like a Texas flag that flew over the Capitol for him and all that kind of stuff to my mom on his behalf, you know, after he, you know, had passed. And, you know, there's a lot of good lessons that he taught me. But, you know, again, you know, for me, you know, coming from that, like, I didn't have any abuse growing up, you know, like I had two really great parents. I had one that was a geneticist. She worked on the Human Genome Project, right, for Baylor College of Medicine. Very smart lady. And then my dad was, you know, a police administrator. Is a really great. In fact, you know, you think about going back in time. He had fought in the Korean. This is how old he was. He fought in the Korean War. Okay, and when he had taken his discharge from the Army, went right to go work for the Houston Police Department, and the licensing agency for police officers in the state that we are governed by now didn't come into existence until 1970. And in 1970, that licensing agency gave him an honorary masterpiece officer certificate. That's how long he'd already been in law enforcement. He was already like a lieutenant for, you know, HPD at the time. But he was one of those guys in the 70s that was fighting for, you know, like community oversight, you know, with the police department to ensure that minority groups weren't being taken advantage of or disenfranchised, right? Because that's – and that was during that period of time, too, when there was some pretty serious demographic changes taking place in Houston. So you kind of think – I mean, you got to, you're talking about during the 70s in a southern state, that was probably met with some resistance, you know what I mean, in a place like Houston. So he was kind of a pioneer. So there's a lot of things that he did and he taught me when I was growing up that I very much value still today. But, you know, again, you know, the optics that I view the world through is completely different than somebody that grew up in a home where they weren't provided with those kind of role models and that type of childhood. You know, I'm extraordinarily lucky. And my wife,
yeah,
who's a homicide detective, right, she grew up in an abused, you know, neglect, sexual abuse household. You know, that stuff was going on with her. And, you know, it's funny that we end up in the same line of work, and we have completely different optics on everything that we see, and it's valuable, right? You know, there's certain things that I miss because I just don't see things through that worldview that she has taught me, and vice versa, right?
Well, that's good. You see, you two are very well matched. Absolutely, it's good because. Like, I'll just say this quickly, and then I'll go to Bill, and then I'll go down to Penelope. I'll open up her mic. But with all the type of work that I've done in my past, because then I turned into a landlady for 18 years, I'd seen enough of social services. I've seen enough. But anyway, my husband's, I was married twice, and my first husband, he used to call me Deputy Dog, okay? I was Deputy Dog, which was really quite insulting. There was no, he would never, you know, support anything that I was trying to do with kids because I was part of the Rodaway Lifers program, Scared Straight First, and that led me into detention, okay? And so I was trying to build some sort of something that I could do with my life, and I always chose jobs that I figured I would do well at because I'd been there. Okay, that was one way of doing it. And so I wore a police uniform just like, you know, the police officers do. I just didn't have the gun. That was it. And I had the patches, the whole nine yards. That's because we took kids into court before the judge, and we had to have, you know, these uniforms on. So with my second husband, Marty, who passed away about 4 years ago, he just had no respect. You know, no respect, you know, for anything that, you know, that I had an interest in. So when you say that, that you and your wife, you know, you're working more or less on the same team, okay, she knows about abuse, she can certainly tell you, you know, so that when you're working and going in, you get a call on the domestic violence. You certainly know all about it now, but she's someone who, you know, she could coach you, like with the kids and so forth, because, you know, she had the abuses, she went through the abuses. And so, you know, it's good to have a spouse who, number one, respects what you do, and number two, who can also help guide you. That's great. I like that. That's really good. Let me go to Bill, and I'll go down to Penelope. Go ahead, Bill. Your mic is open. Good memories.
Well, it's not all bad. Could tell you that. And my family was not my abusers per se, although they just didn't understand me at all, and I didn't get from them what I probably needed. That was one of the reasons was they were older when they got me. Of course, I was adopted, as most people know, and as an infant, I was brought into this family that I don't think my parents were very adept, frankly, at raising children, and especially because my mother had lost a couple of them, and they told her, don't try anymore, you're going to hurt yourself, and they recommended adoption. So that's why Now, my mother's heart was broken the whole life. I didn't realize this when I was young. I couldn't relate to it. But later I did. I saw how, you know, she was, talk about trauma, she was totally traumatized by the last time she tried to have a child, which was the year before I was born. She had one that lived on birth, but only lived for 3 days or something. And it just, my mother was so hurt by the delivery and so forth that she never saw the baby. And, you know, that must have broken her heart. I know it broke her heart. She didn't speak about it a lot, but I think that affected her. And my father was constantly trying to fix her, you know, acquiesce to all what she wanted and so forth, which I saw, and that really kind of upset me. And my sister, too. I had a sister who was adopted a year and a half later. But, you know, in between all this stuff, there were lots of good times. And it wasn't all bad. It became bad when I was sexually assaulted by, you know, outside the family. Mm-hmm. And that lasted for roughly 5 years, three with one guy and two more with a couple others. And that really messed me up. But, you know, before that, I tell you, we used to go on camping trips as a family for our vacations. And I remember that as a wonderful time. And it wasn't like we didn't have a big trailer or anything. We had a little thing you pull behind your car, and it opens up kind of like a tent when you're in the campsite. And my sister and the four of us would go, you know, on for 2 or 3 weeks and visit all the state parks and the Civil War battlefields and so forth, all kinds of things. And I really loved that stuff. So that was a good time. So there were good things. And there was a lot of stuff that wasn't so good.
Right.
But it wasn't.
Well, I can actually look back and remember, you know, fun times and good times. And I can. We did have some fun. We didn't go on vacations, you know, not like that, because they always had the greenhouse business, and they, you know, that always came in the way. It always got in the way. But we'd take, like, day trips, things like that. And I loved Coney Island. I love Coney Island. I don't like it anymore. You know, I mean, it's a mess right now. But, you know, things like that. And, you know, so then the cabin. Oh, my God, that was my saving grace, was to have that cabin. They had two cabins, actually, but the one up more close to upstate New York. I had such a good time there. I'd take a friend, and the cabin was so rustic that even the steps that went up to the loft, it was split wood, you know, split logs. And it had a fireplace that, you know, went up to the ceiling. And it was made out of rocks. I mean, it was just a really cool, cool place to be. And then the lake was clean. It was a beautiful lake. And that was near Greenwood Lake, but this was actually Pinecliff Lake, a little on the other side, New Jersey side. But the point is, I have those good memories. And I think that's what kept me going. It kept me alive because those people, I found out years later, were not my real family, not by blood, but they, and I don't think they knew it. My grandmother suspected it, and that would have been my so-called father's mother, and said it to me at age of 14, "Who are you?" I said, "What?" I thought she had Alzheimer's or something all of a sudden. "What's wrong with you? I see you all these years, you don't know who I am." And she said, "You don't look like any of us. And you have green eyes. Oh, my God. Like a snake." I go, "Oh, gee, thanks." "I have green eyes like a snake." She says, "There's no green eyes on either side of the family. No green eyes." And I thought maybe I was going to lose her, okay, because all of a sudden she realized that I was different. Well, we survivors, we already feel different. And we need to have someone, you know, in our corner. And she was the one that was in my corner. I had two, actually, but she was one. And But as it turned out, she didn't love me any differently. After that, she never brought it up again, but that was the beginning of my realization of what part of the problem was in the family. My mother had gotten raped, and out I popped, and she pushed me off as one of them. That's what happened. And she always mistreated me horribly. So, you see, we go through all these kind of things in our lives, you know, and we can become really bad, you know, we can. Or we can go and get help and move on, you know, and I believe that there is life after abuse. I absolutely do. And I have to say, too, that on the holidays, one thing about my mother that I can say that is positive, we loved Christmas. Oh, my God, we loved Christmas. So we would have, you know, all kinds of trees all decorated. Everything was beautifully decorated. And, you know, I mean, and it was just a wonderful time of the year. And that I found to be very uplifting, very uplifting. So I have some, you know, I have some good memories with my music, with some of the things that happened around the house and things like that. So I can look back and say, yeah, I did have some good times. And I'm thankful for those good times. Let me see what Penelope has to say about good times. Penelope, what have you got to say about good times? Now you had, I know you had good. You just got back from Greece. You had good times. I know you did. Go ahead.
Well, I'm. You know, it's been my. Of course, we always want to rewrite history if we had an unhappy or a abusive childhood. So my main, you know, goal with my children was to create a lot of great childhood memories. So yes, we had a wonderful time. really great. But you know,
that's
I'm glad great. That you know, I'm being called a little bit later on the channel because I really had to think about my gosh, let me think, did I have really happy childhood memories that stood out? Mm-hmm. And I can say we had a ski cabin up in Lake Tahoe and we had a cabin that was in an association, and one summer the association had this scavenger hunt for families where you had to get in your car, right? It was a kind of a thing. We had to have a car, had to figure out the clues and go from point A to point B, and it was a competition. And we all bonded together as a family, and that was the first time we'd really done something like that. And we ended up coming in second. But that's really the only memory that I can share that was good.
Mm-hmm. But at least you have them, okay?
Yeah.
At least you have them.
Yeah.
What's the funniest thing that ever happened to you? Because I'm gonna tell a little story here in a minute. Go ahead.
The funniest thing?
Yeah.
Well, my parents thought this was funny, and I didn't at the time. Now I can look back and say I guess that was pretty funny. But I was in third grade. And my best friend, you know, Kirsten Tegmeyer, was having a costume birthday party. So my mother had this, like, shimmery dress from the 60s that was to the knee. And my father took a Nerf football and cut it in half and put a bra on me. They put a blonde wig on me, and I went as Dolly Parton.
Oh, my God.
With the
That's
ball
funny.
Cut in half to fill the bra. They thought it was hilarious. So that
I like that.
I mean, I was dying. We had to, I mean, when you're like 30, so how old are you? 8 years old? 9 years old? I was mortified, right?
Yeah.
I remember some 8-year-old showed up at our costume party as Dolly Parton. I'd laugh too, right? So that must be the, you know, the funny thing. But I was not, you know, I wasn't seeing the humor in it that then. So I think that was probably a really funny, that's something I could bring up.
That, I think that's hysterical. I mean, maybe you didn't think it was hysterical, but other people see a lot of humor in that. Well, I'll tell you something I did that I was very naughty. I was like, let's see, 16 years old, yeah. And I was quite drunk. All right, I was quite drunk. And so were my friends. They were quite drunk also. And we had a couple that were older, and they had a station wagon. In those days, oh, gross, they had station wagons, and They didn't have any much money, but so that's what they drove. So, but anyway, we had decided that we were going to get ice cream. This is what we were going to do. So, you know, we pulled up to this place. I'm not going to mention the name because, God forbid, if somebody's listening, I don't want them to know that it's me. No. But anyway, we pulled up, and we were drunk. In those days, you know, I have to say, like, the police, if you were drunk, they'd pull you over. They'd say, hey, you know, maybe you should go back home, or do you need help? I'll help you. It was more of a personal type of thing. And then, of course, people were starting to get killed. So it wasn't so funny when people were getting killed. And then we had that organization that formed, you know, with the Mothers Against Drunk Drivers, the MADD. But anyway, so we pulled over to this ice cream place, well known, and we got out. And now here we are, we're drunk, and we're going to have ice cream. What a combination. Oh, my goodness. So, anyway, we go inside, and I was feeling a little bit nauseous, and I thought, well, let me go into the ladies' room. And I'm kind of swaying while I'm walking, and I know this, I'm swaying. And I saw a G on the door, and I thought it was for girls, like in school. In school, it had a G on the door, right? Girls? Girls' room? No. The G was for gents, okay? It was for gents. Now, I go walking in there, and I hear this roar of laughter, And, of course, the ladies' room is not the same as the men's room, and there was no man in there. Thank God there was no one in there. So I'm thinking to myself, I was very drunk, but I'm thinking to myself, I am not going to go out and face all that laughter. I just won't do it. I won't do it. So there is this window. That was definitely above me. I'm only 5'2" now. I was 5'4" at once. Now I'm 5'2". Oh my God! I better stop shrinking. So I couldn't reach the window. I was going to go out the window. I wasn't going to go out. No, I didn't want to go out there. So I took the garbage pail and I turned it over. It was a type that you could turn it over. It's not made like they are today. And I stood on it by the window. And I am crawling out the window. I had no screens. And I'm crawling out the window, and I got stuck. Well, it was funny. I got stuck. So all of a sudden, I mean, I'm in there too long, all right? So the owner of the place, he comes in, He says, get down there for right now, and you clean up this mess, and shame on you, and all this other thing. It's things that a grown-up would say. And I said, I can't. I'm stuck. So I'm stuck in the window. So he sends someone around the building to try and pull me out, like from my arms. And he's at the other end of me, and he's pulling me by my legs. And I wouldn't move. I was stuck. Oh, no. So I'm thinking to myself, my God, what am I going to do? Well, it got to the people outside. Excuse me. It got to the people outside that I was stuck in the window. I couldn't move forward and I couldn't move backwards. And so the only thing that they could get me unstuck was the guy. The guy outside had to get rough with me. He couldn't pull me forward. And he had to push me backwards. And let me tell you something, honey. I ended up with very, very sore shoulders. And he pushed me so hard that I finally went backwards, knocked the guy over who was behind me, who was pulling on my legs. We were both on the floor. Okay? So today I find a tremendous amount of humor in this. I had to get out of the bathroom. And I walked right out the door. I just got into the car. Again, people didn't lock cars then or anything either, you know. And I just got into the car and waited for my friends to come out and take me home. But I will never forget that. Because, you see, this is what happens. You get drunk. You do stupid things. And today I can laugh at it. Another time I was walking down the street, rather tipsy, and I was looking at this guy across the other side of the street, and I walked right into a telephone pole. That was hysterical, too. I mean, I can find humor. I did. I had a knot on my head the next day. But anyway, well, it didn't even take that long. But I look at these things I have humor. We all know I have a tremendous amount of humor. And it's like something you'd see on TV. You know, it's not even something you could picture any one of your friends doing.
The thing about being stuck in the window sounds like an I Love Lucy episode, you know?
I know. Look, I love I Love Lucy. And quite frankly,
yeah.
I have a very good sense of humor. You know this. Today, I can look back at those times and laugh my butt off because, I thought it was funny. So those are the funny things that happened to me in my life, you know, that I can look back and say, oh, my God. Okay. Penelope, you're not laughing. You probably felt sorry for me. But I shouldn't have been drunk walking out on the street. Okay.
That is so hysterical, and getting stuck, that reminded me that when I was a junior, senior in high school, I used to crawl out of my bedroom window. I was on the first floor. I wasn't doing anything about it. I was going to my girlfriend's house, right? But I just, something about getting away with it, you know, sneaking out the window. And I had to go through these shrubs. Well, I did it so many times that I created a path through the shrubs, right? I ruined the shrubs. So my father finally said to me one day, I know you're sneaking out. You're ruining the shrubs. Just go to the front door. But that reminded me, right, of just those acts, you know, when we're younger, of just getting ourselves into things. So I was very much laughing.
Well, you know, at the time, you're mortified. You're a teenager, right, when you do these things. But when I look back, yes, it was like I Love Lucy. You know, it, to me, it was like, I think it's hysterical. And I think what you just said is funny. And, you know, I mean, this is what happens. But I just want to read something here because we're coming to the end of the show. And it says here, some thoughts. Bill, you might recognize this. We are innocent and guilt-free, yet share feelings of shame and fear. We should accept no responsibility for our abuse in childhood. Our low self-esteem and feelings of worthlessness are lies. Our lives changed forever in the moment we were first violated. We were diverted from our destiny. Our scars can become a permanent part of who we are and defining us. We suffer a kind of insanity which can involve deep depression or anger. The resentments we carry are controlling us. We are not alone. We are as sick as our secrets. Recovery is possible if we work for it. We can have a complete change in our character within us and say, it wasn't your fault. You didn't do anything wrong. You were just a kid. Now, I like to read that once in a while. I have others that I like to read once in a while. Because there's still so many people, you know, who are walking around and they have a certain amount of shame. And they feel like they did things that were terrible. And some of us did do some things that are terrible. I mean, I hung out with some really bad kids at times, you know. And they did do terrible things. But on the other hand, I just want to let you know that you, no matter what you do, no matter what you've been through, no matter what you've seen, no matter what it is that's happened to you in your life, that if you find the right therapy, and I happen to have my faith in God, I have that too, if you have, you know, things that you can lean on, things that you can, you know, grasp and say, hey, you know, if you're not feeling well mentally, make a phone call, okay? People out there, you can always call NASCA. And I always want people, too, to realize that our website is darn good. What I just read came from our website. Bill, did you recognize that?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah. And you see, that's what I do, though, because so often when I had been going, before the COVID, going out and doing all kinds of, presentations and so forth, I would take a lot of our information. This is some papers here that I grabbed, I have, right from the website. And our website is naasca.org. That's NASCA.org. The people who are listening, I want you, please, to get, familiar with the website. And those red bars that go across, the NASCA website, if you click onto them, they open up like a menu, as Bill calls. He calls it a menu. And there's all different kinds of articles. Some I've sent some in. Other people have sent some in. So we've had other people on the show that they sent from their organizations and given us and so forth and so on. We have a wonderful website where you can learn how to speak to your children about the perverts out there, the pedophiles, the ones, the children who are prepubescent, they haven't quite blossomed yet, and those are the ones that the pedophiles want to just maul and ruin their lives because it's crimes against children. That's what I call it, and that's what it is. It's crimes against children. And, parents can learn how to role play because so often, and this is unfortunate for children, so often parents are ashamed to speak about things like this. I have many people that say to me, I want my children to stay innocent for as long as they possibly can. Well, you're not doing any service to them. I always say you're doing a disservice to them because we have these people out there who are pedophiles, and they want to get a hold of your child. Even in relationships, say there's a divorce in the family, all right, the mother and father split up, mommy gets herself a boyfriend, and mommy doesn't realize that the boyfriend really is more interested in the children, all right? He may be saying to mommy, I love you very much. And that lady, that mother, will agree with that and think that, and he's very attentive to her. They're very, very slick. And yet there might be one of your children, male or female, that he is really interested in. Now, you don't have to say all of that to your child. I'm just trying to educate those who are listening. But it does tell you how to speak to your children, when it's a good time to speak to your children, what ages. It gives you an idea there. Parents use the bathing suit area. They still haven't gotten over there. They have a hard time saying breasts and penis and vagina. They have a hard time saying those words to their children. So they start out by, talking about the bathing suit area. And, of course, it's all age appropriate, too. Okay, so at a very early age, children can identify with that even better, maybe, the bathing suit area. Well, I know where my bathing suit area is. There it is. Okay, no one's allowed to touch that area except for maybe mommy, daddy, if they're bathing me, or if I have to go to the doctor, all right, whatever. So, there's all kinds of information. I had sent Bill an article on those who are pedophiles, who wrote a whole big thing about how pedophiles behave. That's on there, too. And then the building burnt down. But anyway, I don't know who did that. But we're at the end of the show. I just got the cue here. I want to thank people who called in. You helped make this show. We had a good show. I hope it was informative. And tomorrow we're going to have a guest on and who will be telling their story. So thank you. Good night. God bless. And take care of each other. Talk to you tomorrow.
Blog Talk Radio.